Seth. Thanks, Steve, for inviting me up here. I'm going to give you the experimentalist view of magnetic reconnection. This work was done at Princeton, collaboration with Yamada, G. Carter, and Colesworth. Just give a brief outline. Brief introduction. I'll mention some examples from space and laboratory plasmas involving reconnection. I'll just briefly describe the Sweet-Parker model, which is the most straightforward, simple model of reconnection. Probably many of you are familiar with that. I'll give an overview of the experiment, the research goals, hardware, how we form the plasma, etc. And then I'll spend most of the talk kind of describing four quite independent results which have which we've worked on over the years, over the last 4 or 5 years. Finally, I'll summarize. So, my definition of reconnection is the fundamental plasma process with three key features. The field topology is altered, the magnetic flux is annihilated, and then magnetic energy is dissipated. Now, this process is ubiquitous in all magnetized plasmas, and it's also the most plausible energy source, perhaps, for acceleration and heating of plasma particles in both laboratory and space environments. Now, traditionally, the main problem has been thought that resistive or classical diffusion of the field lines is too slow to explain the observations. So the essential questions that we regard to be the most important ones to answer on the experiment are, what are the characteristics of a real reconnection layer? Because we can actually look up close and measure the detailed topology. What physical processes allow fast reconnection? What processes determine the reconnection rate? And then finally, how is magnetic energy converted to plasma kinetic and thermal energy? So these are the kind of the main questions I'll focus on. And not all of them are completely answered yet from the experimental point of view. So let me just begin with a kind of pretty picture. So this is. Yep. Is it still on? Okay. So this is an extreme ultraviolet image of the solar corona taken with the TRACE satellite. This is pretty recent. It's the best resolution now that one can get of the solar corona, and as you see, there's a lot of intricate structure with the different colors representing different iron lines, which are peaked at different temperatures. So now I'm not going to sit here and interpret this for you. I'm not a solar physicist, but what I'd like to point out is there clearly is localized structure and localized heating with the different temperatures, and very suggestive, of course, of these coronal loops, which are indicative of magnetic field topology. So there's a lot of work going on that support reconnection occurring in the solar corona. So I thought I'd just show a picture. One thing I'd like to mention, too, is that the resolution, while this is the best available, one pixel is about 700 kilometers. And so that already is very much larger than what theorists might expect a current sheet width to be, for example.
Yeah.
It's
100 meters or something?
Yeah. Okay, and some other examples, I mentioned the corona, but in the magnetosphere, back in the magnetotail as well as the magnetopause, reconnection is believed to occur. Space satellites flying through these regions measure magnetic field reversals as well as density gradients. And then finally, in laboratory plasmas, there's a long history of reconnection events, sawtooth oscillations and tokamaks, which deteriorate the plasma confinement, and then also anomalous ion heating and reverse field pinches and spheromaks is attributed to reconnection.
So, you know, every one of your examples there, it's inferred. It's not definitively measured.
Yes.
In any one of these cases.
Right. Steve makes a good point. I was going to point out on the solar corona, we have a very nice overall view. We can see the whole thing all at once, but we can't tell what's happening in detail. In the magnetopause, we have a satellite flying through, and you get wonderful measurements along one side of line, one line of sight. And however, you don't know what's happening just a couple gyro radii away. So you don't really know if, in fact, you're reconnecting a bunch of magnetic flux, for example. And likewise here, the measurements are very challenging in the high-temperature plasmas. And like Steve says, things are inferred. You see drops in electron temperature, for example, here. And here you can measure magnetic fluctuations, and then you can correlate them with the ion heating. But
don't you measure the change on the magnetic field topology during this solar flare?
It's not directly measured. It's inferred from, you know, the loop structures, for example.
But we see it, some loop structures which were originally from the topology, and then they changed. Or is it
in the data? If you assume the loop structures represent the field,
yes.
It's kind of silly not to assume.
Yes.
Then there are changes in topology.
That's right.
On occasion as well.
Yeah.
Do you think it's fair to say that the real problem is actually one of time scales? That means the evolution, the scale on which things change, rather than the heating rate as such. I think these are two different issues, and the heating rate is maybe a step to leave aside for the time being, and to focus on this, on the problem of the rate at which topology can change. Like, for example, I can see that in the plasma tail, for example, magneto tail, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They have this problem also in the sun. They have time scales of 15 minutes. But in the magnetopause over here, is there any evidence for rapid changes? What is the evidence there? Because
yes.
Computers can really just go around.
Well, I think the evidence there is that things are quiescent on long time scales. For example, you have steady transfer of flux, but then there's some trigger that will set off, you know, global disturbances. So that I myself don't completely understand. I don't know if anybody exactly understands how that happens.
The solar magnetic field, of course, changes directions.
Yes.
Or in other words, it's a plane. You don't have to go from the southwest field to the northwest field, right?
Yes. That's considered as one possible trigger mechanism.
It has nothing to do with the reconnection site, because it just comes to what.
Yes, but it affects whether there is reconnection. The direction of the solar wind field determines whether reconnection occurs or not.
Is the solar wind field uniform?
No, I don't think it's uniform. I mean, the Earth's dipolar field is northward here, and then the solar wind field can be northward or southward, and it could have components out of the board as well. And so.
But I think Norman is thinking of small scale variations, right?
Yeah.
Do you know that actually? Norman is really says it has a southward, a northward component for a long time, and then all of a sudden it really does change. But that is an exterior influence, of course.
Yes.
I'm asking that question. I'm not saying that you know that for a fact. I'm asking, why should it be uniform? It shouldn't be, right?
No, I don't think it's uniform, no. So let me just describe the Sweet Parker model for those who are unfamiliar. This is it's the most, probably the most basic model of reconnection. It's a steady-state 2D incompressible MHD fluid model, resistive MHD model. And so you just imagine two regions of opposing flux which come together, and then a layer is formed here. So by simply considering force balance across and along the layer, you can get the relation that the plasma flow out of the layer is at the Alphane speed defined using the upstream magnetic field. The conditions of incompressibility and continuity give you this relation. And then if you apply a simple Ohm's law, resistive Ohm's law, you get this relation. So putting these together, it's straightforward to show that you can get a normalized reconnection rate, which is proportional to 1 over the square root of the Lundquist number. Okay. And now, however, the Lundquist number is very, very large in most plasmas of interest. And so it gives you a reconnection rate that's much too slow to explain the observations. Okay, so let me describe the objectives of the experiment then. So MRX provides fundamental data on the physics of reconnection. It takes advantage of a 2D quasi-steady state reconnection layer, which really is unique in laboratory experiments to be able to form this kind of structure. And this allows studies of both local and global reconnection issues. Okay, so the main goals then from the start were to test the validity of these long-standing 2D models, such as the Sweet-Parker model, to investigate the structure of the layer, to study the energy conversion process, which some may argue is the most important consequence of reconnection. And then finally, to determine the role played by non-MHD effects. And these actually are the dominant effects in both breaking the flux freezing constraint as well as providing the heating possibly. And then finally, future experiments will address further issues.
What do you mean by
2D meaning that there's no variation in the third direction.
But are those fields exactly isoparallel, or they have some angle?
We can control that to a certain extent.
No, that's not what 2D means. We have a different definition in this context than you do in your papers.
Yeah.
2D just means there's an ignorable direction.
Right.
Perhaps 2.5D, some people use that.
You mean when there's a B along the...
Yeah, when there's a B along the third direction. Yeah, so to answer that, we can control it so it's anti-parallel, and we can also adjust it so there's a field in the third direction. Okay, so here's a picture of the device. It's not too big, as you can see. These are external field coils to provide equilibrium, and there's coils inside the chamber which actually form the internal magnetic fields as well as provide the plasma breakdown, and I'll describe that in the next slide. So imagine this is a cross section. It's actually a toroidal shaped coil. And there's two sets of windings in the coils, a ploidal winding and a toroidal winding. So the formation sequence I'll just describe briefly. Initially, we set up a quadrupolar field like this. And then when this is set up, we fire the second set of coils, which produces toroidal flux inside these cores. We call them flux cores. So the changing flux inside the cores induces an electric field around the outside. Okay, that causes the plasma breakdown and causes a current to flow around the outside of the core. That flowing current then produces a toroidal field in the plasma and creates a rotational transform in the plasma. Okay, so by ramping up or ramping down this field, we can either inject flux or we can reduce flux in the plasma. Okay, so in this case, we are injecting flux from the core into the plasma. And in doing so, you can form a vertical current sheet like this. And we call this push reconnection. Later on, when the currents ramp down, you're reducing the flux in the plasma, and it's kind of pulled back toward the flux core. And in doing so, you form a horizontal current sheet like this. Now, just from practical considerations, this one is easier to form and to study because of a longer time scale that we have available to us. Okay, so the pole reconnection is the geometry I'm going to focus on today, and in which all the measurements are based on. I should just mention that, so this is toroidally symmetric then around the device. So you basically have a uniform current sheet flowing in the toroidal direction. Now, one thing that's worth mentioning is exactly this point about the third direction. As you see in the 2D picture, these are non-distinguishable situations. However, if you look at the three-dimensional case, whether you put no toroidal field in or identical toroidal fields above and below the sheet or opposite toroidal fields above and below the sheet, you get very different situations. With no toroidal field, you just have anti-parallel reconnection. We call it null helicity reconnection. In this case, with equal toroidal fields, the field lines reconnect at a 90-degree angle. And then in this case, where you have opposite toroidal fields, again, it's anti-parallel. However, now the reconnection occurs at an oblique angle.
It's not necessarily 90 degrees, is it?
It doesn't have to be 90 degrees, no. So it could vary. In MRX, these two situations are studied. We haven't been able to study this one due to hardware constraints. This case has been studied at the University of Tokyo in a similar experiment. You just mentioned the plasma parameters. The density is about 10 to the 14 per cubic centimeter. TE and TI are roughly in the range 5 to 30 EV. Magnetic field strength, 200 to 500 Gauss. Lundquist number is about 200 to 1,000. So this, of course, is nowhere near 10 to the 12th like you have in the solar corona or interstellar medium. However, it is much larger than 1 in the sense that the plasma, on a global sense, can be approximated by MHD. And the mean free path compared to the reconnection layer is an adjustable quantity by changing density, for example. And so this is very useful in trying to change the operating regimes of the experiment. You can go from a fairly collisional case to a fairly collisionless case. And our working gases are hydrogen and helium.
And you have C of omega P and rho I about the size of omega P I, about the size of delta, which is the reconnection layer.
Right. This is the thickness of the layer. And this basically means that we have the magnetic pressure outside the layer balancing the thermal pressure inside the layer. That will give this relation that rho I is about C omega PI. Okay, so one of the main advantages then of studying reconnection in this device is that we can measure everything directly and in great detail. So what we have is a 2D arrays with little magnetic field coils inside them. Okay, and so in one plasma discharge, we can measure the magnetic field topology in this entire region. The poloidal flux is represented here, and I'll discuss that in more detail in the next few slides. We also have various electrostatic probes to measure the density, electron temperature, plasma flow velocities, etc. So we can really try to capture the overall dynamics of the reconnection layer.
A lot of hardware inside this plasma.
Yeah. And then the good question is, how do they affect the plasma? And for the most part, these diagnostics don't seem to affect the plasma very much, although there are some that do, and we have to take precautions. So here is an example then. See, we don't have a second overhead, do we? Okay. So what I'm going to show then is the data measured by this probe here, okay? And the reconnection layer, as you remember, is horizontally across this region. So earlier on and then later on in the discharge sequence, initially you have vacuum field, which is very X-like. And then later on, as we ramp the currents down, you see this pole reconnection layer formed. So it's very clearly defined here. Now based on these, these are measured every 4 centimeters in a square grid, and then it's interpolated. So assuming axisymmetry, we can get the poloidal flux function simply by integrating, and you see the very nice layer form there. Okay, so based on these measurements, we can analyze various things. We can follow the motion of flux lines and determine the reconnection speed into the layer, for example.
Is the global equilibrium steady throughout this time that some of the plasma is doing by itself?
I wouldn't say it's doing it by itself. It is driven in a sense because we're injecting flux or reducing flux.
All the time.
Yeah. However, it occurs in the steady state, though, for roughly like 10 or 20 Alphane times.
So it doesn't depend on the rate at which you're pulling the flux through the X point, this shape here?
This shape?
You're pulling with your boundary conditions.
That's right.
The current in these coils.
Right.
Right? You change that current, and that pulls flux through the X point, and you start to form this reconnection.
Right. Now, the plasma, we can control the rate to an extent, but in the end, the plasma kind of chooses what it wants to do. We pull flux out at a given rate simply by the voltage, say, we set on our banks, except the plasma it doesn't scale linearly, for example. I mean, the inductance of the plasma is determined by, you know, its own resistivity, whatever microphysics is going on in the layer.
And this one I drew you on the second floor. It looks rather thick as compared, for example, to the naive expectations one would get from Sweet Parker region.
That's right. The Sweet Parker picture would be about an order of magnitude smaller than this if you plug in these parameters, and it is thick because as we'll show, the resistivity here is not classical. And then one more illustration of what we can measure. So now what we're doing is looking at the profile of various quantities across this midplane. And for that, we had a very high resolution magnetic probe, because what we worry is exactly this point. What if the layer is thinner than we think it is and we just don't have the resolution to see it? So we built a probe with half centimeter resolution, and this pretty conclusively answers the question how thick the layer is, because as you see, we have over 10 measurements across the field reversal, and it is roughly about two centimeters or so. The half width is about 2 centimeters. Okay, and here are Lamier probe measurements of the density across the layer and then the electron temperature across the layer. So you see they both kind of have a peaked profile in the layer. Okay, maybe I should mention one other thing is, now there's a lot of physics quantities important to analyzing the physics, which we derive from all of these measurements. From the global magnetic field, we can calculate the electric field, basically the out-of-plane reconnection electric field, just by the changing flux. From the magnetic field measurements here, we also get the current density just by taking the derivative. And from those, we can calculate the resistivity, effective resistivity, E over J. And then from the density measurements, from the temperature measurements, we can get an estimate of what Spitzer is.
Tell us why your error bars vary so much, for instance, in that density panel, mid panel.
Yeah, here? Well, this big one is because the gradient occurs here, and then these are taken, each of these represents about 5 plasma discharges, each of these points. So just a slight change in the radial position of the plasma will produce this big error bar, and otherwise it's just a shot-to-shot variation in those. These are taken in one shot, and that's why this is just this just represents the measurement error, not the shot-to-shot error. Okay, so the first kind of general question we asked ourselves was, how does the third component of the magnetic field affect the reconnection process? In the well-known theories, people just look at the 2D case and then they go ahead and do their analysis. And if you add the third direction, it doesn't really change analysis. Okay, so. So here are two cases. The first one, there's no out-of-plane toroidal, there's no out-of-plane field. And in this case, there is a out-of-plane field, which is on the order of the poloidal field. Okay, so you see that the shapes of the reconnection layers are very different in the two cases. It's very narrow and thin here, and then here it's a lot broader, and furthermore, no point forms. Additionally, the reconnection speed is a lot faster in this case than this case. And you can kind of see by the way the flux is piled up here. Okay, so the motion of the flux into the layer is about 3 times faster here than here. And it's for the same discharge conditions.
Is that what the out-of-plane field symmetric and the isosymmetric?
This one?
Yes.
This one has out-of-plane field symmetric.
Yeah. Yep. Okay, so it's not pitching. It's not pitching.
Yes, yes. So the way we understand this, first of all, the toroidal field reduces the compressibility of the plasma. It makes it essentially incompressible. This case is quite compressible. secondly, with the toroidal field there, you have an absolute minimum B configuration here. And that kind of, we think that stabilizes this current channel and allows it to grow like into an O point. There's further reasons though, which we'll get into in more detail, but introducing the toroidal field can alter the microphysics in the layer. For example, the instabilities that might be occurring in there are going to be altered. This case is low beta, this case is high beta, for example. And that can have, as we'll see, an effect on the reconnection rate.
In the top one, you've got the field going like this, and it's coming together.
Uh-huh.
Is there evidence that the flux sort of interpenetrates by interchange before it starts to reconnect? I mean, in the bottom, you can't do that because you're pulling field lines together like that to make them interpenetrate. They would have to bend them. But in the top one, they're coming together like this. Is there some, you know, if you looked at this, toroidal direction to see if this layer sort of
has a ripple or
ripples around.
Well, the field lines are tied anyway in that place.
Yeah, the field lines are tied right around the cores.
They tie themselves, they go round.
Yeah.
So they can.
I guess the short answer is we can't see that if it is true, but it's a good question. I mean, I haven't considered that myself. You're asking whether there can be some kind of...
It's a simple way to make the area of the sweet Parker layer much larger so that you can increase the reconnection rate. It's just to wrinkle the sheet.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. That we have looked in the third, you know, toroidal direction a little bit, and it's fairly symmetric, but we haven't had the resolution, say, to see if the thing ripples, say, on the order of a centimeter or something. Yeah.
Probably if you have a set of probes,
yeah. Right.
You would see this effect.
Right. I think, actually, Russell looked at that exact question. I'm not sure what the conclusion was from that analysis.
Well,
I can tell you that if you may have this interchange, you may get very fast interchange. So the stabilizing effect of the out of plane field is.
This might even be the one place that the Zarian and Vishniak actually apply it.
What is the density gradient if you cut it across? How would that look?
The density gradient? It's I showed that it's quite sharp on one side, but not as sharp on the other. Here, it pretty much jumps up from background level.
That's 10%, right?
Oh, sorry, yeah. Background level up to here. Same with here. So, the gradient is over a few centimeters.
Looking at the picture you showed, the previous one.
Yes.
It's probably only a small number of field lines that have actually changed topology. Can you actually, or have you quantified that?
Yes. You can count how much flux has been reconnected.
Not many, right? How many is that?
Well, let's see. I mean, the reconnections.
What?
32.
Yeah, right. I mean,
this occurs.
This plot is probably maybe one or two. Of course, you need to make some sense out of this.
Yeah, you can easily basically, if you know the electric field, then that is essentially the speed of the flux coming in here. Right,
yeah, what I'm after is there actually a contradiction? I mean, it's possible that you reconnect. Is it possible that you actually reconnect only a very small amount of field lines and have not actually done a real reconnection, a fully satisfactory reconnection?
Well, how do you define?
You have maybe thought about this.
Well,
it seems to me that it's not much.
You're asking what turns the reconnection off?
I mean, something turns it off,
so
it's clear.
He's asking what the reconnection is.
Yes. This, like I said, over 20 or 30 microseconds, this is fairly steady. So you have a steady inflow rate.
So that what looks like an elliptic point over there actually has field lines going in.
This. Yes.
If I go around the tortoise, you're going around like this.
Yes.
Right? See, when you do have a magnetic field and in a sort of steady configuration, you have a mean field coming out of the plane, then the motion of field lines is like a Hamiltonian mapping.
Yeah, I mean, you may be able to think of it like that. There's a transform.
In a Hamiltonian mapping is one with an elliptic and x points.
Mm-hmm.
Not with something where you have two field lines which are parallel like that. It never meets like this. These are contours of some Hamiltonian.
Okay, right.
I don't know, maybe the flux function or something like that in the Hamiltonian in this place.
Mm-hmm.
And mappings generically will give you elliptic and x points.
Yeah, but this is the whole point about reconnection, is the fact that it produces this very singular and in the limit of zero dissipation, right, completely singular current sheet at that point, which does repel the lines on both sides to give this very flat, straight thing. And
true, that's in the case without a magnetic field coming out of...
Right.
Well, even with a magnetic field that happens for a bit, and then resistivity allows the reconnection, you can almost watch it between 270 microseconds and 280 microseconds.
True, but he hasn't plotted anything inside the... So in an equilibrium sort of configuration where, a long-lived configuration should have this sort of a topology.
And if you go beyond 290, won't that shrink into its neutral point?
No. It actually keeps going for a while, but then the situation changes. The situation changes after 290, so it's not exactly relevant anymore. Basically, what happens is that a spheromak grows there.
Well, that's on a slower timescale.
Yeah.
So it's quasi-static.
Right. It's really this section that can be studied in this context.
It goes back to what we were talking about yesterday. If you do have a magnetic field distorted by a contracting cloud, for example, and you introduce finite resistivity,
mm-hmm.
then you get first of all the cusp forming, and then the next type interface spontaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So that's because it's not this nice little geometry that we get in the definite sense on one side.
There actually is a hypothesis that, I mean, here the resolution is being limited, but there's some hint that O points are trying to form here as well, but then they're just kind of swept away because it's unstable there. So that's a possibility.
This is a question that people talk about, the tearing of the sweet path, the layer, the lower one gives you
magnetic
islands formed within the sweet
path.
And I'm trying to visualize how you form magnetic islands when you have magnetic field lines and 90 degrees. Shouldn't you form a spiral?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a spiral.
This is a spiral.
That O point, it spirals around it.
Yeah. Right. Okay, so the key point, I guess, is that introducing a third component really gives some striking differences between the two cases.
Were you ever able to make it to
two? Two O points.
Two O points in there?
No. I don't think so. And so here we try to quantify a little bit. So in the top panel, we're measuring this reconnection speed. So it's the motion of the velocity of flux lines into the layer.
In kilometers per second?
Yeah.
This will answer to some extent to Axel's question.
Right. How much flux is reconnected? And this is...
5 kilometers per second, and for how many seconds did we watch there? We watched
about, it goes on for a little longer, say 20 microseconds. It's basically like a
centimeter of flux, of field lines.
This is the thickness of the layer, okay? So here's the merging angle of the field line. So we vary it. Here is the totally anti-parallel case. And then we increase the field line to here. And so as you, so basically the reconnection speed goes down as you introduce the third direction. And then likewise, the thickness of the layer goes up as you introduce the third component. I mentioned before the reduced compressibility in the presence of BT, which affects the reconnection speed, but also this anomalous resistivity is much smaller when you introduce the third component of the toroidal field.
Well, it looks like the factor 3 is going to get a lot worse if you go towards 0 degrees.
Yeah, this may actually be I don't know if I'd pay too much attention to the shape. That may be an artifact of our experimental limitations. We'd like to be able to specify the magnitude of the toroidal field, but in reality, what's happening is the plasma is limiting. It only allows so much field to penetrate in there, despite what we apply at the boundary. So I think really what one needs to do is to have an external coil to study this regime down here.
So in the null case, you have a merging angle of 180 degrees. Is that correct?
The null case is 180, yes.
It would be really interesting to introduce additional component without changing the existing.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. But in that case, we need the external coil to do that.
Has there been talk of putting a current down the symmetry axis?
Yeah. Okay, and the one we were talking about, the thickness of the layer. Now, it's a curious thing. Two fluid theory and simulations, as well as space observations, suggest that delta scales a C over omega pi. And so here we took it upon ourselves to really measure, to get a scaling in the experiment. And what we see is that delta is about equal to 0.35 times C over omega pi. So we ask ourselves, where does this factor come from? Now, Harris had equilibrium theory of a collisionless current sheet from way back in the 60s. And that's a fairly well-known result, that you get deltas about C omega pi, and that you get a particular shape of the profiles, notably an arctangent function, a hyperbolic tangent function for the magnetic field, and which is exactly what we see. The toroidal the magnetic field shape is exactly a hyperbolic tangent. So by working out this Harris theory with a few generalizations, we were able to show that, in fact, the measured thickness agreed with this modified Harris theory pretty well. Now, Russell has worked on, basically we were surprised. I mean, why does the experiment agree so well with this theory, which is just an equilibrium current sheet with no reconnection? There's no electric field in the model. And the reason that we came up with is that the dynamic time scale of the theory is much slower, is much faster than the reconnection time scale. So the reconnection time scale actually is just a small perturbation on this collisionless theory. And so as long as the crossing time of the ions is faster than the reconnection time, then this theory ought to hold, to lowest order. And that's kind of what we see.
Scott, is there an inconsistency between the two fluid theories and your results in that you have a delta that's about the same for the current and the electric field?
The electric field is actually uniform. You're saying the magnetic field?
Well, don't the two fluid theories have this very narrow current sheet,
yes.
Where the current is on the electron.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And you find it on the ion scale.
Right, that's right.
So does this sort of disprove those theories, or is it a different parameter?
Well, those theories are strictly 2D. The ones in which you see the very narrow current sheet on the scale of C omega PE, those are 2D. And actually, Mike Shea, I guess, when they went to 3D, they actually saw these C omega P scales break up turbulently. So, of course, in this experiment, you have 3D, and we haven't seen anything on the smaller than C omega PI.
There's some suggestion that in 3D that little thin layer had been wrapped around in the space, the border. I mean, the actual reconnection is still going on the C of omega PE, but that's not a flat surface anymore. It's a very wiggly surface.
There are some other things that the two-fluid theory suggests that might be testable. For example, a spontaneous generation of its own toroidal field just from Whistler. There's Whistler modes propagating along the layer, and supposedly that could turn the electron motion into the toroidal direction. So these things actually haven't been looked at yet.
It seems to have more errors as delta gets larger. I would have expected it to be the other way around. Can you tell us why the error bars seem larger and larger?
Okay, let's see. We'll try to remember. For the larger deltas, I suspect that may actually be an artifact of just the unfolding process. When we go to larger deltas, it's actually a lower discharge voltage, and the plasma is not as robust. So the shot-to-shot variation is bigger in those cases. So I don't think it's a very interesting interesting reason why.
It's because these points are an average over.
Yeah, each of these points are averaged over many shots. And these shots, to get such large deltas, the discharge voltage had to be pretty small. And then the plasma wasn't as robust and not as reproducible.
Could you remind us of the speed of electrons?
Sorry?
The speed of electrons, are they close to C, or how is it actually?
Speed of electrons?
No.
No, well, they're not. Yeah. That's inferred. Okay, so some of these aspects we've discussed, they were summarized in this, what we call the generalized Sweet-Parker model. So what we measure was an enhanced plasma resistivity over Spitzer. And also, if you remember, in the Sweet-Parker model, the downstream pressure is assumed to be small. However, in the experiment, it's not small. And so we took that into account, the downstream pressure. And then furthermore, the compressibility is actually somewhat substantial, represented by this term here. So taking these all into account, you can redefine kind of an effective Lundquist number. So here you see the modification due to compressibility. This is the modification due to the downstream pressure. And now if you replot the normalized reconnection rate, this is measured and this is measured now, you get a very nice scaling with the generalized model.
Sorry, just to understand that this is not tautologous.
Uh-huh.
You have this enhanced non-classical plasma resistivity. You measure that, we're measuring the electric field.
And the current. So eta star is just defined as E over J in the middle of the layer. That is, we think it's a finite, there's limited volume basically downstream, and so after a while your electrons, which have been heated due to reconnection, presumably fill up this volume and then it creates a back pressure.
So it's a finite volume effect which maybe wouldn't persist in
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Well, but the sun isn't, you know, the field lines themselves might be going into the sun.
I mean, any particular
Although the way we kind of interpreted this result was that, I mean, the downstream pressure, as far as I can tell, is usually neglected, and especially for explaining solar flares, for example. But if you have two coronal loops, say, coming together, you know, in the presence of a third one, I don't know. You certainly can imagine a situation where the downstream pressure isn't negligible. This is just gas pressure that we've accounted for. In null helicity, there is no toroidal field. No, that's a good question.
How much does eta star vary in this data?
Eta star varies by about up to an order of magnitude.
Factor of 10 over there.
Yeah.
So you measured the experiment.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the key point here is these are kind of trivial effects, but the real question is this non-classical resistivity. What's producing it? And so that's.
Which factor is it off?
Huh?
Which factor is it off?
Off from Sweet Parker, off from Spitzer, up to a factor of 10 or so. It's off. So we tried to vary things a little bit, and we plot the ratio between the measured resistivity and Spitzer. We plotted against the mean free path over delta, so this is kind of a collisionality factor. And as the mean free path gets longer, this anomaly goes up. And then the drift speed also we infer from the current. And if you divide that by the thermal speed of the ions, you get kind of a constant over a wide range of densities. And so that's kind of a clue, perhaps, that you have some current-driven instability there that's providing the non-classical resistivity. But these right now, this is still speculation. At the end of the talk, I'm going to discuss a little bit about the fluctuation measurements that they've just recently done.
Could you change, for example, in your experiment, the magnetic field intensity? Would without changing the mean free pass?
Not exactly. It'll scale together because as you increase the magnetic field, you'll also you'll have more ionization, and yeah, because the plasma is formed based on the district. Yeah.
Because this would be very.
Yeah.
This would actually allow to find out whether we have this parameter control by the ion scheme depth or
that's
the Larmor radius.
Yes.
With some scaling of the
right.
My question is actually because if it's the current of instability, you would expect maybe that this factor depends on the magnitude of the current. So if you did the same experiment at 10 times the smaller currents, you may get different scaling so that the resistivity is actually nonlinear in the current. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it's already clear the resistivity is nonlinear with current. But as far as the
enhanced one, you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Do you know the power?
No. If I did, I wouldn't believe it anyway.
Especially the inference from the picture on the right is that the resistivity isn't the issue. The resistivity is designed to broaden the current layer until V drift is roughly equal to V thermal I times 3.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you didn't broaden the current layer, the current density would get bigger, and the drift velocity would get too big, and it would trigger a large instability, which would then broaden the current layer and bring that parameter V drift.
Right.
Cooling time is long.
What's
cooling time?
Cooling?
Yes. I mean, thermal velocity doesn't
go out. That's the current. It's not. Well, I mean, it's true. That's very flat.
That's not really cool. Yeah. I mean, it's factor of 3, I guess. So. best we could do at the time. Okay, so let me just go on to a slightly different topic, which is the ion heating during the reconnection. So I should just briefly mention that the detailed measurements of ion heating had not been done before. During reconnection. So what we did was we had this insertable spectroscopy probe that was able to measure ion temperature in this limited region. Okay, so we can actually get some really precise information about whether the ions are being heated positively due to the reconnection. So to cut to the chase, this is what we saw. This is ion temperature versus time. The reconnection occurred during this time. Okay, so the two curves here, this curve corresponded to the case where reconnection was driven. So we allowed the current to ramp down. It induced the electric field in the plasma, and that induced the V cross B inflow of the reconnection layer. In this case, there was no reconnection. We didn't let the current ramp down, so the electric field is very small. So you see the clear difference. In the one case, the ions are heated. In the other case, the ion temperature remained roughly flat. But furthermore, we can take a look at the E and the J, because those are measured quantities. This is basically the power dissipation, E times J. And you see it ramps up during this reconnection phase. But more interesting yet is if you integrate this, that gives you the dissipated magnetic energy over time. So this is the total energy dissipated, and you see the remarkable agreement with the rise in ion temperature.
If the ions are flowing out of that region,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't you expect them to have a temperature profile more closely related to the instantaneous heating rate rather than the total power dissipated?
Let's see, the ions flow, let's see, at, I'm just trying to remember the transit time. Well, what?
100 kilometers a second at 10 centimeters.
Right. Actually, I remember the main point is this probe actually is 5 centimeters big. So the transit time through that is actually a fraction, you know, is a fair fraction of this, first of all. And
so you're measuring some kind of average temperature.
Yes. You're measuring the average temperature of the whale.
Some of them are hotter than this, and some of them are colder than this.
Right. But basically, the average temperature in the layer goes up clearly. Now, that was the null helicity case with no toroidal field. And here, we also look at the case with the toroidal field. Okay, this is just reproduced from the last plot. So with a toroidal field, the heating is much smaller. Okay, and likewise, the dissipation is much smaller because the speed at which field lines have come in was much slower.
What is the downturn in the interval for the co-helicity?
Yeah, in that case, the electric field changes direction because the current has kind of dropped below zero and come the other way. And so that isn't exactly relevant anymore to this part of the...
So you've actually reconnected all the available flux.
Well, we've used up all the available volt seconds in our supply. we haven't reconnected all the flux. It's come in and then it's going to change direction again. The current's has gone through zero and it's going to... Sorry, the derivative of the current has changed sign.
Are you going to talk at all about turbulence or a spectrum in this region? Fluctuations?
Yeah, let me get to that. And then finally, the heating was actually shown to be localized in the layer. So this is the radius, and this is the rise in TI. So here's a magnetic field reversal shown for reference. And out here, the temperature stays roughly constant, whereas here they're heated by 70 or 80%. So basically, we were fairly convinced that it really is the reconnection process providing the ion heating.
Scott, what fraction of the dissipated magnetic energy shows up in ion thermal energy?
I'll get to that in a sec. Okay, one other point. Now, an alphanic outjet is kind of almost synonymous with reconnection. People expect there to be an alphane flow out. But like I mentioned earlier, this downstream pressure can really hinder that. We measured this downstream flow directly and found that it was roughly like 20% of the alphane speed. And that's consistent with if you do a simple force balance accounting for the downstream pressure. But the interesting part is we estimated the classical viscous heating due to this flow. In the classical picture, a predominant amount of ion heating is going to come from viscous heating of that flow. In our case, the viscous heating was very, very small. Okay, so you had all this ion heating, but it was unaccounted for by any classical process. So we did an energy balance. So just considering the volume of the layer. Okay, this is just from Braginsky. So we reconnect about 5 joules of field energy, we dissipate 5 joules of field energy. The classical ion heating, which is predominantly due to classical viscous effects, is very small. It's like 17% of that 5 joules. However, this ion thermal energy, which was measured, something like 64%. Now, this includes estimates of, we're considering a fixed volume, right? So you have convective loss and heat transport losses, which is what Ben, you were asking about. So those are accounted for. And so what you're doing is you're heating a moving kind of mass of ions that continuously flow through this box we're considering. Okay, so so now if you look at all these terms, what turns out is that these are all very small, and then these things are estimated, and you're left with this unaccounted for portion, this non-classical heating. Something like 48% of this 5 joules is unaccounted for. So the conclusion is that the ions are actually heated non-classically during the reconnection process. And we looked at the heating, the fractional heating of the ions compared to the dissipated field energy as a function of this enhancement in resistivity. And there's a marginal scaling with that. Okay, so that's kind of a hint.
If somehow one associates, you know, enhanced resistivity with the electrons, right? Something that's scattering the electrons.
Well,
how does it transfer that power to?
Right. Now, there's a question, an outstanding question about what is carrying the current here in the layer. If it's diamagnetic current, which we think it is, then it's not clear that the electrons are carrying all the current. the hint here is that whatever mechanisms, microphysics happening in the layer is producing the enhanced reconnection rates or the fast reconnection, it seems like that same mechanism is also directly heating the ions. Okay, and there's some, now that we have some hypotheses now, let's see. Just recently, a classmate of mine back at Princeton, Troy Carter, for his thesis work, he's looking at the fluctuations inside the layer and trying to determine if there is a particular mode he can identify that's correlated with this heating as well as the enhanced resistivity. So these are electrostatic fluctuations across the current sheet. Here's the potential fluctuations. And you see they're actually kind of peaked at the edges of the layer. Here are the magnetic fluctuations. And they also seem to peak up inside the layer. Now, I have to mention that these are very preliminary results, but the suspicion is that there's some electrostatic current-driven instability that may be generating the enhanced resistivity.
Is there something like this V-profile effect?
I'm not familiar with that. Yeah, I'm not familiar with that. let's see, Drake's group at Maryland, they have their own hypothesis. They think that all of this data can be explained by Whistler-mediated reconnection, or basically just collisionless inertial effects. So that's still outstanding. People back at Princeton are looking for electrostatic fluctuation or current-driven instabilities that might be able to explain this. I guess Russell has worked out some simple instabilities in the layer that may actually explain this direct ion heating. So since I'm over, let me just summarize then. We've gotten fundamental data on reconnection on a laboratory experiment. I think a lot of these things were observed in detail for the first time. The structure of the reconnection layer, dependences on the out-of-plane magnetic field, the fact that the reconnection rate agrees with a generalized Sweet-Parker model, and finally that the reconnection process was observed to heat the ions non-classically. And I think one of the key results that's spawning further work is that this is kind of a solid basis for fast reconnection being a consequence of non-classical effects in the layer. Now, that's not no surprise. People have been looking at this for a long time, but I think it's really the first clear confirmation that some microphysics in the layer really is accounting for the fast reconnection as well as for the ion heating. So I'll end there.
Could you put that slide on where you have the density, the summary of the three quantities versus time?
Summary.
Near the end.
Oh, the fluctuation quantities?
Yeah, right. Density, flux, and what determines why the density is low on one side and high on the other?
Here.
In other words, the experiment seems symmetrical when you're doing it, so what determines one side growing and the other one not?
Right, that's a good question.
That's the density fluctuation, by the way.
Well, let's see, this is just the density, actually.
This is the ion density, right?
This is, well, it's, yeah. I mean, it's we assume, I mean, there's quasi-neutrality should be good, and it's a hydrogen plasma. the reason we think is there's a couple reasons. One is a finite aspect ratio effect. So it's kind of like a Shafranov shift in the tokamak. You have the plasma rotating on the outside, and there's some centrifugal forces possibly. The other reason, I don't really know if it's a reason more than an observation, is that if you look at the field profile is also slightly asymmetric. It's higher.
It's reversing, as you said, it's hyperbolic tangent.
Yes, it's reversing, but it's not centered about zero, and that's because there's a background quadrupole field based from the external coils. And if you account for, now if you if you have pressure balance, then because the field is lower on the outside than the inside, then you must have a higher density on the outside than the inside. If you look at pressure, if you just do P plus B squared is constant, you actually do see something flat.
I'd just like to make one suggestion, a very generic suggestion. To me, it seems like you're pushing magnetic fields in, mm-hmm. in an impulsive manner.
Right.
Right. You're doing it like, as you said. And you have density and homogeneities. That's a picture of the density and homogeneity.
Right.
Well, that's the environment for the Richtmeyer mesh of instability, which you haven't mentioned at all. Namely, when you have an acceleration in an environment, you have a new kind of instability arises, which is like the Rayleigh-Taylor instability, mm-hmm. anytime you have an acceleration. That's why I asked you about the fluctuations in the ions, because if the medium became turbulent, this is what happens in the Richtmeyer-Meshkov instability, you would have a turbulent viscosity or a turbulent heating, not by any of the processes that you mentioned.
Well, when you say impulsive, right, I mean, this is impulsive, but it's on a slow time scale compared to Alphane. So it is a pulsed experiment. However, if you look at the formation of the plasma, it's actually slow formation. I mean, you have magnetostatic equilibrium during the process.
He's also saying that the viscous sensation is weak, it's small.
Classical viscous is weak.
Dynamic instability.
Yeah, but wouldn't you then expect some significant viscous dissipation as opposed to
no, the viscous dissipation that he measures is by putting in the classical viscosity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
No idea. I'm suggesting a turbulent viscosity rather than a plasma.
Yeah, it could be a turbulent viscosity as well, but the point is the only energy source is the dissipation of magnetic energy here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure to call it a steel fast reconnection because you're very bit fast because of your size of the laboratory equipment, but current lids are still rather thin. They are probably I understand that it's at the moment it's not possible to find out whether they are some sort of Larmor radius or ion ion depth.
Mm-hmm.
But still, if you apply this in context of astrophysics, for example, on the scale of the galaxy,
yeah.
We get enormous long time scales. So.
Well, it depends on the resistivity, right?
No, but I'm saying that you still should eject everything from your current layer.
Mm-hmm.
And the thickness of this current layer, unless it's exploit, is determined by either the plasma radius or ion skin depth.
Mm-hmm.
And these are microphysical parameters.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever you are talking in terms of laboratory experiment, these microphysical parameters may be larger than those that are determined by sweet Parker layer
mm-hmm.
or classical resistivity.
Right.
But when you are coming to astrophysical
mm-hmm.
in the scales, in this case, your microphysical parameters become really tiny compared to these scales. And your sweet Parker layer mm-hmm. may be thicker than the layer that is determined by the anomalous effects.
Possibly, yeah. I don't know. I guess the Lundquist number is what
yes.
what really captures that
yes,
difference.
Yes, but eventually you are ejecting everything at the velocity not larger than the alpha speed
mm-hmm.
from the whole layer. And in your case, I believe you presented a compelling evidence that your layer is determined by some microphysical instability. And this gives you some thickness,
yeah.
Which is larger than the sweet Parker scale thickness. Sweet Parker thickness scales as the size of your region.
You mentioned the presence of Weiss granules.
Sorry.
You mentioned the presence of Weiss granules. So, do you have any evidence of dispersive effect being relevant, like due to the Hall effect?
We haven't observed Whistler effects, but the people at Maryland, when they do a self-consistent 2D simulation, they see Whistler mode. So in our case, we actually haven't observed that.
There's also something that they always claim is that sort of move over towards Petchek type shape.
Mm-hmm.
In connection, when you get this anomalous stuff, and that Petchek becomes the
mm-hmm.
solution. There's no evidence in your experiment.
Right.
It still looks sweet Parker-like. It's just a slightly broadened
mm-hmm.
mode right there.
Right.
This section.
Cross-emphasized
variation of the collective resistivity.
Mm-hmm.
Dow's positive, etching mostly, we have the same
variation.
Right. So that seems apparent that with some simulations where they made it depend very critically on current, and therefore the enormous resistivity of theta, I think. So the enormous resistivity was peaked in the center. And what happened then is that they flipped over into what looked more like a Petchek.
Mm-hmm.
And do they still claim that?
It's a 20-year-old simulation.
I think
No. But there were try and all work, and they were saying that they see exploits. At some point, they were claiming that they see exploits when they. There was a shy at all.
Yes. They say that it's Petchek.
Yes, they were saying that because of this resistivity, they are forming exploits. Actually, I understood it mm-hmm. like that. And because of that, they have reason.
The Shea model is, well, we can talk about that.